All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Merry Christmas, Celeste Headlee.
Merry Christmas, John Hockenberry.
Yeah, holidays are so meaningful because they are an accumulation of memories, really. And I think maybe it's a good time to reflect on the way the world used to be.
Maybe when things were a little easier and the economy was a little better.
Well, not quite. We're going to look back on a Christmas that had a particular resonance in history in 1941. There was a lot of good and a lot of bad there. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, Christmas in 1941 would have been just a couple weeks or so after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the beginning of our involvement in World War II.
Exactly. In that year, everything changed for Americans.
We're going to tap into the archives here at WNYC and also dig into some really amazing tape from the Library of Congress.
We'll hear from our contributors like we always do, and you're going to recognize them. And we'll take a look at how Americans are escaping from these times as well as engaging in them with an amazing year in sports and at the movies.
So take a guess for me. Do you have any idea how much a gallon of milk cost in 1941?
I could just guess, but I have no idea.
54 cents. And you could get yourself a brand new car for $850.
The book For Whom the Bell Tolls was a bestseller then, a Hemingway classic.
And people couldn't afford TV sets yet, so they all relied on radio. Here's some of the news on this December 25th, 1941.
The news is grim from the Pacific. This morning, with Japanese soldiers advancing throughout the city, Governor Mark Atchison Young officially surrendered the crown colony of Hong Kong to the Empire of Japan, marking the first time in history the British have surrendered to an invading force. British and Canadian soldiers have fought gallantly side by side for the last 17 days. The day will forever be known in Hong Kong as Black Christmas.
On the home front, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill is in Washington, D.C. to confer with President Roosevelt on the best military strategy to overrun the Axis powers. He gave a joint address with President Roosevelt from the White House last night.
Let the children have their night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us grown-ups share to the full in their unstinted pleasures before we turn again to the stern task and the formidable years that lie before us.
Your call, please.
To do your part in the war effort, telephone companies
ahead,
have asked for you to refrain from all but the most urgent calls. The New York Telephone Company has this message for freedom-loving Americans. The long-distance lines must be kept open for defense use on this Christmas Eve. Since there will be no truce over the holidays, we feel sure you'll understand.
One message did get through from the Pacific. From the Marine garrison on Midway comes this message to the New York Times. We are still here. Merry Christmas. That's the news for this morning, December 25th, 1941.
After the Pearl Harbor attacks, our friends at the Library of Congress down in Washington took to the streets to get reaction from ordinary Americans about the times we're in now. We're joined now by one of them. Mike Stevens is in Dallas, Texas. Mike, how long have you lived in Dallas?
Well, I've been living in Dallas ever since 1934, which is about 7 years.
And what do you do for a living?
Well, I'm working in Dallas. I'm a houseman, chauffeur, cook, and a yard man.
We're asking people today, what do you think about this war we've just gotten into?
Well, my thoughts about the war, which I've been thinking over for some considerable time and reading, I figure we have a hard task to do.
Well, what do people like you think of this whole situation?
Well, the general colored people, I believe they will speak the same and portion with me, what I'm saying now, is because in talking with different ones, they talk the same thing.
Do you find them willing to bear their part and pick up arms and fight for their country?
Well, yes. I believe they feel like I felt when the news heard over radio that Japan had declared war on the United States. Everybody felt in sorrow and woke up with a strong determination mind is to go forward, to do the best they could.
Mike Stevens, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us. We're going to hear more reactions to the war and the attacks on Pearl Harbor all this hour.
It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to a special edition of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. We're imagining it's Christmas, 1941.
We're here on Christmas Day, 1941. In a minute, we're going to hear how some ordinary Americans are feeling about the war we're about to fight. But first, we have some news from Washington. Celeste?
Hi, John. Yes, just last night, President Roosevelt gave a major address from the south portico of the White House during the lighting of the National Community Christmas Tree. The president was joined this Christmas Eve by his new ally, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill. We have some tape from that speech all the way from Washington. And President Roosevelt seemed to address people who might be wondering if they should still celebrate Christmas when so many Americans are about to be sent to war.
How can we give our gifts? How can we meet and worship with love and with uplifted spirit and heart in a world at war? A world of fighting and suffering and death. How can we pause, even for a day, even for Christmas Day, in our urgent labor of arming a decent humanity against the enemies which beset it?
Roosevelt pointed out that Britain has been in this situation for some time already, and then he turned the microphone over to British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who reflected on the wartime holiday.
This is a strange Christmas Eve. Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle, and with the most terrible weapons which science can devise, the nations advance upon each other. Ill would it be for us this Christmastide if we were not sure that no greed for the land or wealth of any other people, no vulgar ambition, no morbid lust for material gain at the expense of others, had led us to the field. Here in the midst of war, raging and roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearths and homes. Here amid all the tumult, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home and in every generous heart. Therefore we may cast aside for this night at least the cares and dangers which beset us and make for the children an evening of happiness in a world of storm.
Churchill is reportedly in Washington to plan the strategy for the war, and tomorrow he's going to address a joint session of Congress, the first by a foreign leader.
Voices there of two leaders waging this war. The formality of leaders who have to speak to the whole world. But here on The Takeaway, we like all kinds of voices, and we're going to turn now to some people who agreed to sit down for our microphones at the U.S. Library of Congress, thanks to a young fellow named Alan Lomax. Ordinary Americans, voices of ordinary Americans, you're going to hear them all hour. And we're going to start with two people from Austin, Texas, Mr. and Mrs. Jurosik. Mrs. Jurosik, let's start with you. My first question is really, are you for or against this war?
Well, I'm for it.
And you have a son that's going to fight, and you're ready to see him go off to fight?
They got to fight.
Why do they have to fight, Mrs. Jurosik?
Well, they've been attacked, so they've got to fight.
Well, let me talk to your husband then. Mr. Jurosik, what do you think we're fighting for here?
Well, we are fighting those greedy dictators. It's for the greedy gain that they're trying to make. They're trying to take stuff that don't belong to them.
Who does it belong to?
Well, rightfully, that's like Czechoslovakia belongs to Czechoslovakia. Poland belongs to Poland. Holland belongs to Holland, but Hitler's took it over.
What do you think about this country, the United States? Do you think it's the land of liberty?
It's the best country under the sun.
And you, Mrs. Jurosik?
Well, I think it is now, and I think that's the reason we got to fight, to keep it that way.
And you two think war is the only way to keep it that way?
Yes, because I believe they're going to win the war.
No doubts about going to war?
Yes. Well, the country wouldn't be any good if let them have it.
I've got a son in the Army.
That's what I understand.
Served 3 years, and they called him back. He's been back about a year now.
In the reserve.
And you're fine that he's going to be on active duty now?
Well, wherever he's needed, he's ready to go, and I'm willing for him to go.
If you were eligible, would you go?
I'd like to go, but they wouldn't have me. My age would bar me.
Now, you're a working man. Do the other union men that you know in Austin have the same opinion? Would they all pick up and go?
Well, I believe the majority of them would go. But you'll always find men that would rather stay at home than anywhere else.
After it's over, what kind of peace do you think we ought to make with Japan, with Italy, and Germany?
Well, of course, that would be my honest opinion, you know. I think they ought to set up a different form of government.
Do you think they should have any power?
I think they ought to do away with some certain countries and do away with their tongue.
The tongue? You're talking about the language. Which languages should we do away with?
One's German. Don't let him speak it anymore. Divide Germany into other little countries there. Give each one of them a slice of it and do away with it.
What do you think about that, Mrs. Jurassic?
Well, I think that shouldn't be in Germany anymore. I think they've caused enough trouble. I think when they whip them, they ought to not have Germany anymore.
You blame the Germans more than anyone else?
I do. I don't dislike the German people. I know a lot of German people that I don't dislike. But I remember in the World War was before, the way the thing went. And my children's daddy died from the effects of the World War. And now I've got a boy I got to go, and Germany's caused the whole thing, and I just think that Germany's caused enough trouble that we don't need any Germans.
And you feel the same way, Mr. Jurassic?
Exactly. I think that they ought to do away with that one country.
Well, what about Japan?
I don't think there's going to be much to Japan after the war.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Joe Jurassic. Thanks for talking with us.
Coming up in a minute, why Uncle Sam wants you to buy war bonds. It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
Gasoline is an important defense material. Use it economically.
Don't gossip about ship movements or about the fact that a friend in the armed forces is being transferred to some outlying base. New York City's own station, WNYC.
I would die to be with my Dolores.
To be near her eye.
Hey, before the champagne corks pop, there's still time to think for a minute about your year and snap a picture or shout out what you believe says 2010 in your world. Be a part of our national year-end slideshow. Instructions at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to a special edition of The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, the New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston. We're imagining it's Christmas 1941. Now back to John and Celeste in 1941.
And so we've got some news takeouts that we're following this last week of 1941, and what a week in what a year, with the attack on Pearl Harbor still fresh in all of our minds. America is thinking about this war that's going on. But Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau says we should, as Americans, do much more.
We've got to step up the sale of war bonds to $1 billion every month. All of us who earn regular pay should set aside an average of at least 10% of it every week for buying war bonds.
Here to explain what war savings bonds are all about is Louise Story, an enterprising woman who covers finance and business for our friends, the New York Times.
Good morning.
So a war bond, I'm buying what exactly?
So the Series E bonds are the ones that they want everyday people out there, farmers and business owners and workers of all sorts to buy. They cost $18.75, and after 10 years, they'll pay you $25.
And they're going to use this money to support the war that I guess, have lent them, right?
Right. So you'll be lending the money, but they're saying, you know, it's a good investment for you. When you do the math, it only works out to about a 2.9% return per year.
Which is nothing like what you were getting back in the 1920s. That's
right, exactly. You remember the Liberty Bonds back then. The other way that you can help support the war is you can buy stamps. They're selling war stamps right at the post office, and those are a lot cheaper. You can buy those for 10 cents.
It'd be a good Christmas gift.
It would be a good Christmas gift, and I wonder if, 60, 70, 80 years from now, people will still be thinking about these kinds of things, war bonds, as a good
investment.
No,
hopefully we won't be having a war then.
Indeed. Louise Story, a business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Any bonds today? Bonds of freedom, that's what I'm selling. Any bonds today? Scrape up the most you can. Here comes the freedom man, asking you to buy a share of freedom today. Any stamps, any bond today.
Our next takeout is all about that declaration of war that Congress passed earlier this month. You'll remember President Roosevelt made a very convincing speech to Congress on the morning after the Pearl Harbor attacks almost 3 weeks ago.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
After the president spoke, Congress approved the resolution in the record time of 33 minutes. Joining us now is our man in Washington, Todd Zwillick.
Good morning, Celeste.
Why did President Roosevelt have to go to Congress to declare this war?
Well, the Constitution reserves the power to declare war for the Congress and for the Congress alone. Article 1, Section 8 says that only Congress shall have the power to declare war. The president can't go to war to Japan on his own. He needs the consent of the Congress and through them the consent of the people.
And does that mean if the Congress says no, there's no other avenue, no other option for the president?
Well, the president is allowed to send troops overseas. He is the commander-in-chief of the military, but a declaration of war does a lot more than allow the president to send troops overseas. Doing things that the president needs to do in an emergency, like suspending habeas corpus or holding prisoners without trial, would be unthinkable without a declaration of war.
Here's another excerpt from that speech where President Roosevelt urged Congress to declare war.
We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us.
After that kind of language, was there anyone in Congress who was against his proposal?
There actually was one dissenting vote. The war declaration passed the Senate 82-0, but there was a vote against it in the House. That was Congresswoman Jeanette Rankin. She's a Republican of Montana. Of course, students of history will remember that she also voted against the war resolution against Germany in 1917. She's a pacifist.
And how did people react to her no?
Well, there were some boos and hisses in the chamber. This is a patriotic moment for the House of Representatives and for the American people. So Congresswoman Rankin was not well received.
Well, we're going to hear next about how American citizens are responding. That's Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
Our last takeout comes from you, ordinary Americans all over the country, responding to the devastating attacks on Pearl Harbor earlier this month, speaking into the Library of Congress's microphones.
We were in our living room waiting for the symphony to come. For a moment, we were stunned. We just couldn't believe it at the moment. At first, it didn't seem true, and then the more we heard, we were horrified.
That's Dorothy Baer from Buffalo, New York. And many of you are telling us your opinion of Japan after those attacks. Here's Edward Crane from Dallas, Texas.
I admit that while I've never had a very high opinion of the Japanese, their conduct in this particular situation has lowered them even in my estimation of them, which is low enough.
And some of you are putting the blame on our leaders.
All I got to say, they did the wrong thing by electing President Roosevelt. Although he helped some, he helped a whole lot. But still, therefore, he should have kept out of it.
It's affecting other people in different ways, but especially mothers who now have to see their sons go off to war, like Mrs. Whitaker from Austin, Texas.
And I'm glad to say that I have one son in the Army and that he's patriotic enough, and I have that Christian spirit in me to give our son for the cause, and I'm glad I did it.
But some of you got right to the heart of the matter and wished it wasn't happening at all.
I'm a housewife in my 16th year and living in New York City. I'm very sorry the United States has to get into this war.
We'll hear more reaction to the war throughout this hour. It's Christmas 1941 on The Takeaway.
But God bless the child that's got his own.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
You're listening to a special edition of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. We're imagining it's Christmas 1941.
Coming up, a look at sports 1941. There were a lot of headlines, but first, a word from some of our underwriters.
Billy Brown, the smoothest, coolest guy in town. The chicks all seem to dig his jive.
Hey, tell us, Bill, how can we arrive?
It's easy, Jack. Any gal gets sent when you flash a smile by Pepsodent. You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
And now we're going to hear about women in the news for today, 1941.
Women in the News, presented by the Knee-High Bottling Company, Harlingen, bottlers in the valley of Royal Crown Cola.
There has to be a first time for everything. And Washington, our nation's capital, is claiming the first American baby born during a blackout. It happened at the doctor's hospital during an air raid rehearsal. All the lights in the building, including the delivery room, had been shut off. Carol Ann Heater, who was about to enter the world, hadn't been told about blackouts. Luckily, there were several flashlights around, and the tiny daughter of Mr. and Mrs. John Heater, he's a clerk in the War Department, was greeted with plenty of light. And that brings up some of the good that is coming out of our defense preparations. War or no war, we'll all know lots more about fire hazards, and we'll know our neighbors better, too. Take Mrs. DeWitt Peterkin, wife of a New York banker. Last year, she was just an average young wife keeping house for her husband. Today, she is a cog in the country's defense machine. She works all day and two nights a week as an air raid warden. Her husband drills in the home guard two nights a week, and fortunately, they are the same two nights that she is busy. Mrs. Peterkin is interesting because she is typical of thousands of women in our country today. Here are her air warden duties. You'll admit they're a far cry from matinee, shopping, and a gin rummy. In order to check every fire hydrant and gas main in her neighborhood, Mrs. Peterkin walks a beat 2 blocks wide and 10 blocks long twice a day. She had to learn the location of gas and water outlets, and she had to make the acquaintance of every resident, how many children they have and where invalids live. These also are an air raid warden's business. To qualify for the job, Mrs. Peterkin went to school at the American Women's Voluntary Service for several weeks. Ask this energetic worker about her private life, and she says, "Private life? I don't know the meaning of the word. This is the moment for public service. Only by serving publicly will we ever again have private life as we have so happily known it." And now for the names of the ladies who will receive the 6 handy home cartons of Royal Crown Cola Free. Mrs. J. Beatty Smith, San Juan. Mrs. Jim Corey, Mission. Mrs. H. C. Settles, Mercedes. Mrs. Lee West, McAllen, Mrs. L. F. Milliken, Wesley Co., and Mrs. Wade Davis, San Benito. Cards entitling you ladies to your free 6-bottle cartons of Royal Crown Cola will be mailed tonight. They're redeemable at your favorite grocery store or Royal Crown dealers.
That's all you need to know about women in the news right here on The Takeaway.
And remember, ladies, we'll give away 6 more handy home cartons of Royal Crown Cola. So listen for your name.
The camera highlights in the world of sports.
Well, it was certainly a year in sports in 1941. Some of the highlights, and you know, we've got legends all over the place. Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Joe Louis. One legend's a pony.
They're turning into the stretch with Whirlaway on the lead. And this jockey looking back is not running wide. It is Whirlaway by 3 lengths. Whirlaway is coming on away to be another horse. to win the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness.
Whirl Away, of course, the horse that won the coveted Triple Crown this year, the fifth time that's ever been done. It was a fast but erratic chestnut colt that had a streak of wins already when it went into the starting gate at this year's Kentucky Derby.
And they're away.
And he came from the back of the Derby and flew through the final quarter to win by 8 lengths. He did the same at the Preakness with a 5.5-length victory, but then at Belmont, it was all over. He catapulted into a 7-length lead after a slow start. At the final turn, he seemed to veer off course until legendary jockey Eddie Arcaro straightened him out to get that Triple Crown with an easy 2.5-length win. Then in the boxing ring, there was the challenger.
The very capable challenger, Billy Cudd.
Capable. Well, some thought he was a credible threat to the heavyweight title held by Joe Louis. 17 challengers have come before him, and this year, Khan was supposed to be different, trying to become the world's first light heavyweight champion in boxing history to win the heavyweight crown, and the crowd believed he could win. Khan was actually, if you watch the fight, was actually winning on the scorecards up to around 13. Louis heard the words of his trainer in his ears. The reporter said, "You have to knock him out to win." And in the 13th, Louis pummeled Khan, knocking him down after 38 minutes of fighting. The referee counted 10 as Khan got on his feet. Split second, too late. He was counted out. So, Joe Louis, 1941, remains the undefeated heavyweight champion, maybe even the greatest of all time. It was certainly a good year. In my book, it's always a good year in sports for baseball, but not so much for the Brooklyn Dodgers. They smelled victory in the World Series against the New York Yankees this year. They had a chance to even the series in Game 4. Dodgers had a 4-3 lead in the ninth inning with no Yankees on base. Then, something happened.
So again, we've come up to a 3-2 pitch. Two out in the ninth inning. Casey gets by Henrik. It's all over. Pitcher starting his windup out there again. He's all ready now. Watch it. Here it comes. He swung, fouled the ball. He swung at the ball and missed it. The ball gets away from the catcher, and Henrik goes to first.
Oh, I live in Brooklyn. How much does that hurt? The error, and it was charged as an error, kept the Yankees alive. They came back to get a 7-4 win, and they won the series. A couple of baseball legends to talk about here in 1941. You know, which record do you think is going to stand the test of time here? Sportsman of the Year this 1941 has to be Joe DiMaggio. Record-breaking 56-game hitting streak, inspiring a song.
Joe DiMaggio.
But what about Ted Williams?
Remember this date, man. September 28, 1941. It may be a history-making day.
At Shibe Park in Philadelphia, 23-year-old Ted Williams did it. Boston Red Sox, 23-year-old, what kind of batting average is a .406 batting average for the entire season? Try that for a record.
.406, not too bad of it.
And not too bad a season. I mean, his best yet. But there's one more legend who still gets all the attention, even though he's retired.
Hey, gang, come on, here's Babe Ruth!
Hello, boys and girls.
Oh, Babe!
That's the way, just call me Babe.
Why do they call you Babe?
Why do they call me Babe? Well, I'll tell you. A few years before you were born, I was playing with the Baltimore Orioles. And when I went to Baltimore, and in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was my first appearance. And when the coach saw me come in, he said, "There comes this big baby." So Baby has stuck to me ever since. Hello, Sonny. What's your name?
Billy Ruthven.
Billy Ruthven. How old are you, Billy?
12 years old.
Well, you're a pretty big fella to be 12. You got a favorite team?
Yes, the Dodgers.
Uh-oh.
How about that?
Well, there was some cheers and boos in that. I don't know. Now, what is your name, Sonny?
Edward.
Edward who?
Sheedy.
Sheedy, yeah. Well, how old are you?
Seven.
Have you got a favorite team? What is it?
The Yankees.
Yankees. Good cheer.
I'll look at the movies of 1941 in just a minute. It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And I was looking at my own mailbag here and was struck by a Christmas card I received from one of my friends this year. Dark, kind of somber background, a single candle. Really captures the mood of what we're all feeling, I think, this Christmas of 1941. A nation at war against Japan and Germany at the same time. But then I went back and looked at some old cards of holidays past, and I found this very different card from 1911. A very happy-looking Christmas bell with two children holding ribbons. They're little angels. Almost a different world, it seems, than just 30 years ago. Listen to this.
Any little girl, that's a nice little girl, is a right little girl for me. She don't have to look like a girl in a book, if a good book she could be.
That's from 1911. Sounds like they don't have a care in the world, those singers. Think about it. It's much less than a lifetime ago, but it's almost impossible to imagine back 30 years ago. Before the Great War, all of those millions of people who died in Europe were still alive. The Great Depression, the stock market crash, all in the distant future. The Communist Revolution in Russia hadn't happened. Getting through the just past 19th century seemed a miracle all by itself. Hard to recall what it even felt like. Hey, in 1911, people stopped hand-cranking their cars. The starter was invented. Standard Oil was broken up. Of course, the horrible Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire here in New York City transformed our idea of safety, where we all work. You know, someday I suppose we'll have the recording ability to preserve the voices from any time and go back and hear and see what it was like, maybe even more than 30 years ago. But now we're left with these distant echoes from 1911. Just 11 years into the new 20th century, there was such a feeling of satisfaction. Napoleon and his horrible wars were over. We thought they were horrible back then anyway. We survived the war between the states here in the United States, freed the slaves, became a bigger economy than our old colonial master, England. 1911 seemed like a long summer historical day.
Any girl looks good in summer.
I was looking at some other important events back in 1911. The great composer Gustav Mahler died. Complicated fellow. Do you like his music? He never got to hear one of his most ambitious pieces performed, The Song of the Earth, it was called, premiered in October of 1911 after he was dead. I don't know if you've heard the piece, but it contains all this brooding sense that there's something right around the corner, something big and maybe not so great. What did Gustav Mahler know? What's he thinking now? One last thing before we go. I love this. 30 years ago, movies were a silent novelty, and most were made in Europe. But in 1911, a man by the name of David Horsley opened a little movie studio out in California on Sunset Boulevard in a little place the world now knows as Hollywood. Want to know how to be in on this conversation? Well, start it early every day by subscribe to the Takeaway texts. Send the word START to 69866. We'll tell you about the next day's show and give you a chance to weigh in and then be on the program. That's START to 69866. Normal texting rates apply.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston. We're imagining it's Christmas 1941. Back to John and Celeste in 1941.
It's great looking back in this 1941. And I think if you look back a decade, you realize that what made it through the Depression was the movie industry in the United States. President Roosevelt talked about that recently.
We have seen the American motion picture become foremost in all the world. We've seen it reflect our civilization throughout the rest of the world. The aims and the aspirations and the ideals of a free people and of freedom itself.
course, President Roosevelt speaking there. For me, it's more about escape, and that's why we have invited Rafer Guzman, our own movie correspondent here, into the studio to talk about the year in movies, 1941. I think escape is what most Americans do when they go into the movie theater. Don't you agree?
I think that's true. I think you want to get a little popcorn, sit back, enjoy the show, and forget about your problems.
And it's only a penny, right? I mean,
that's right.
That's the best part about it. So what are the films do you think are big this year? One thing that struck out for me was this movie Maltese Falcon. I mean, you see a New York screenwriter, John Huston, going out to Hollywood trying to make good. Dashiell Hammett, of course, who wrote the book,
right.
Maltese Falcon. What do you think of this movie?
I think it's really great, and I think it's got a fantastic acting troupe in it with Humphrey Bogart.
This new guy. Let's listen to this clip and hear.
What have you ever given me beside money? Have you ever given me any of your confidence, any of the truth? Haven't you tried to buy my loyalty with money and nothing else?
What else is there I can buy you with?
Humphrey Bogart there, kind of a funny voice.
Yeah, very, very distinctive voice. This is sort of one of his first breakout roles I think we've seen from him so far, and he does a great job in it as a hard-bitten detective. It's also a very dark film, even though it is a good escapist film. Dashiell Hammett, you know, he knows how to throw some punches, and he's not messing around here.
Well, a lot of people were wondering if Dashiell Hammett would translate to the screen. Here, I think it does, but I wonder if this Humphrey Bogart fellow is going to get kind of cast in these characters from here on out.
It's a good question. He's got such a great face for it. I guess he could be a victim of typecasting in the future.
Indeed. Well, another New Yorker, huge in New York, comes out to Hollywood, tries to make it big. Listen to this movie.
I am the publisher of The Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests.
The movie's called Citizen Kane. Orson Welles plays the main character, and this is supposedly the climax of the entire movie right here. Did he say Rosebud, Rafer Guzman?
He did say Rosebud. I don't want to give it away, but it's a word that has great symbolic value for this character of Kane.
Now, this is a long movie. I have to say, I understood The War of the Worlds on the radio much better than I understood this film. I liked it, but it was pretty tough going.
I mean, I think the real value in this film, that what's gotten the critics excited about it, is the technical innovations here. You may not notice it as an average film goer, but the way that the cinematographer Greg Toland uses focus and what they call deep focus to put all the points of the picture in focus so that you see everything clearly, the foreground and the background and the middle ground, it's pretty tremendous. It's almost three-dimensional the way he does this.
You're kind of a technical guy, all this camera stuff moving around.
Well, you know, Orson Welles is too. I mean, people say that he's a real megalomaniac, but if you notice, he shares his title card of director with Greg Toland, the cinematographer. Directors usually don't do that. Mm. They usually want to put their own name on the screen alone with nobody else on it. So he did that.
Rafer Guzman loves Citizen Kane, not doing great at the box office, but
That's true.
Say maybe a legend in the making.
I think we will see more from this guy.
All right. It seems to me maybe the most significant film this year is about a story that anticipates where we are here in 1941 with the war and Pearl Harbor so close upon us. Sergeant York, tell us a little bit about that.
It's a true story based on the life of Alvin York, the most decorated soldier from the Great War of 1914. And this, you know, this film has got Gary Cooper in the lead role, and it's great to see Gary Cooper playing sort of a yokel of sorts, and he does it very well. Basically, he's living out in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee. It's so remote they don't even know there's a war coming, and they wind up getting drafted, and he doesn't want to go. He's a conscientious objector, but he actually goes to the mountaintop, he sits and he thinks about it, and he decides that, yes, indeed, he's got to come down and fight for his country.
Well, let's listen. Here's Gary Cooper.
I believe in the Bible, and I'm believing that this here life we're living is something the Lord done give us, and we got to be living it the best we can. And I'm figuring that killing other folks ain't no part of what he was intending for us to be a doing here.
Oh, love that Gary Cooper.
Oh, he's great in it.
It's got to be an Oscar contender because it so coincides with the way we're feeling now.
I think it does, and I think it really has a strong message to say that you can reconcile your personal, your religious beliefs with the way that you want to fight for the mm-hmm. country. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably says a lot about where America is right now and the feelings that people are having about the war that's upon us.
A lot of people are going to identify with Sergeant York. I think you're right about
that,
so. Right, for Guzman. All right, the Disney movie, after the, I thought, a little too serious Fantasia, beautiful, but, not much of a movie as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
apparently most of the public was with you. Yeah. Not a big success at the box office.
Who would have thought a little flying elephant takes the hearts of America away? What's the movie?
It's called Dumbo, and it's sort of a return to form for Disney, I think, after this extravagant Fantasia that they've done. I think it's a really wonderful film. It's really heartbreaking. It's about a little elephant whose ears are so enormous that he becomes an outcast. And, of course, he's got a kind of a Jiminy Cricket character, a mouse that, right. Is on his shoulder that figures out that his ears are, in fact, so big they can actually help him fly.
And you fall in love with this little elephant from the beginning.
Do. Dumbo! You flew! Boy, am I stupid. Why not think of this before? Your ears. Just look at them, Dumbo. Why, they're pointing wings. The very things that held you down are going to carry you up and up and up.
Well, Dumbo will be competing for sentimentality with How Green Was My Valley. That's got to be an Oscar contender, just released.
Definitely. A very populist film about the coal mining family in Wales. It's pretty difficult to overlook the sentimentality in that one, but it's very well done. John Ford, terrific
Huge
director.
Cast. Walter Pidgeon, Maureen O'Hara, Anna Lee, Donald Cripps, Roddy McDowall, young kid. Let's finish out the year by noting, and we talked about this a little earlier in the hour, Hollywood, they broke ground on the first Hollywood studio like 30 years ago.
This
fall, yeah.
It was 30 years ago. Well, how far we've come.
And we dominate the world in movies.
Indeed we do.
Rafer Guzman, the Takeaway movie contributor.
I saw a clothes horse, the ravin' buck.
And they tell me that a man made a vegetable truck.
I didn't see that. I only heard.
Just to be sociable, I'll take your word.
I heard a fireside chat.
I saw a baseball bat.
And I just laughed till I thought I'd die.
But I'll be done seen about everything when I see an elephant fly.
Now let's hear from some more ordinary Americans on this Christmas 1941.
My name is James Pop. I live in New York City. I work on the custodian staff at City College. And what Roosevelt did, he couldn't do anything else. It was forced upon us. There's nothing else for us to do but fight.
Yes, I'm ready anytime. The Uncle Sam needed me, I'll be ready. I know Mexico is my country, but I left my country. And the longest I've been living here, and they've been treating me good, I'm American citizen now, and I just call this my country.
My name is Richard Kwan. I work for the city of New York. I think President Roosevelt's speech was excellent. And I think it is the only means of meeting the aggression of the Japanese by declaring war. And I think all the people of the United States will be behind the president because his speech was an excellent performance of his duty towards the people of this state. And I assure you that every working man will be behind the president in his hour of need.
My name's Willie Clay. I'm from Benson, Arizona. I was born and raised on a cattle ranch. I've rode bulls and bareback horses, and I'm here for this big show, and what we all got in mind now is this war. What I think of it, I'm coming 21 years of age this next month. I got to register the 16th, and I'm going to volunteer in for this Navy, because I think their clothes fits more like Levi's, and besides, men can get in there and do action.
We're leaving you with this music by the German-American opera singer Lotte Lehmann. It's from a radio recital that was heard all over America this Christmas, 1941. Before she started singing, she urged listeners to put aside the despair that surrounds us and live in the hope that a time will come when all nations and races will be free.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
My
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.